Well, good morning, everyone. Today, we are going to talk about field underwriting for both life and health insurance. One thing I want you to understand from the beginning is that this test that you are preparing for is all about vocabulary, knowing what words mean. And so we really spend a lot of time making sure that you know definitions of words along the way. Keep in mind, you don't have to understand the concepts completely. But as long as you have definitions, then you can start making sense of the concepts. So I hope that makes sense in itself. So this will be our first chapter over field underwriting. Now, first, let me give you a few test-taking tips. They're going to be really important for you along the way. First, it is all multiple choice. So you need to make sure you eliminate answers. You should be able to eliminate at least two answers, get it down to two, read your question again, and then ask yourself which one is the better answer for the information given in the question. If you'll do that, your chances go up tremendously of finding the right answer. Really, the most important thing that we can talk about is going to be your reading skills. You have got to make sure that you are reading every word. Because as human beings, we like to scan information. On this test, if you just scan the information, you don't read every word, you're going to miss an important word like the word all, except, every, always, or never. Words that'll change the meaning of a question or an answer. And so very important that we work on your test-taking skills along the way. All right, so let's first go ahead and start with a test question for you. The question is, what is consideration on the part of the insured? And I have three answers for you here, A, B, or C. So you just need to pick which answer do you think it is? Okay, so you should have your answer by now. Now let's talk about the question itself. In the question, what is consideration on the part of the insured? What word or words are going to be important? Well, hopefully you are saying the word consideration. Now, you need to know what that word means in the insurance world. Because outside of the insurance world, it means I'm thinking about something, I'm being considerate, blah, blah, blah. Well, let me show you a quick video about the word consideration and see if this helps you find the correct answer along the way. All right, so.
Consideration, something of value that each party promises to the other. For the insured, their consideration would be the answers on the application plus their payment of premium. For the insurer, their consideration would be promising to pay in the event of loss. So consideration is something of value.
All right, so now we all have a definition for consideration. Now let's read our question again. What is consideration on the part of the insured? Is it A, deciding which type of policy to purchase? B, selecting riders to add to their base policy? Or C, paying some premium? Hopefully now, after seeing that video, you know that it is C, paying some premium. That is the value for the insured, as well as their answers on the application. This is why definitions are going to be so important as we go along. All right, so let's go ahead and jump on in here. As far as definitions go, first we need to know what is insurance. The first thing you need to know, insurance is the transfer of risk to an insurance company. The whole reason there is an insurance mechanism is we are transferring the risk of a loss to the insurance company, whether that be like life insurance, health insurance, or possibly even car insurance. So let me show you a quick picture here. Car insurance. Now you might ask yourself, John, what is that? I would tell you that was my Ford Explorer a few years ago. You would say, well, John, where is it? And I would tell you it's on top of my mailbox. And you'd be like, well, John, why are you parking on top of your mailbox? I'd be like, well, duh, I have a 16-year-old daughter. All right, I could probably just stop right there. Now, I thought I could teach her to drive, which was mistake number one. So we were in front of our house. Thank God it was our house. And we were going to learn to parallel park that day. So we were sitting in the vehicle. I sat there for probably a good 5 minutes going over where to look, look in your mirrors, looking over, you know, how to turn the wheel, all that fun stuff when you learn to parallel park. And so I said, Tara, are you ready? She said, yep. Well, the next thing I know, her foot was on the gas. We were in reverse and we were backing up over my mailbox, ripping it out of the ground from the base and high centering my vehicle on top of it. Well, that is why I have insurance. I was transferring the risk of that loss to the insurance company. Now, some good news, bad news. Good news is my daughter is now 20 years old. She is off at San Diego State enjoying the beautiful San Diego weather. She got her car. It's in one piece. I think all the mailboxes in her neighborhood are in one piece. Bad news is my son is 16. I know. Well, I've learned my lesson. I'm not teaching him how to drive. I'm letting somebody else do that. All right, but that's what insurance is all about. We're transferring the risk of a loss to an insurance company. Next, once you get licensed, there will be an agency contract between you and the insurer. That agency contract will spell out both of your duties. That agency contract contains what's known as the express authority. This term express authority you need to know for your test. That's what's written in the agency contract between you and the insurer. Next, you as an agent, you're also called a producer. You are the one that completes the applications. Next, the insurance company, another name for them is the principal. So if you see the word principal, they're talking about the insurer. Now, with life insurance, there is a beneficiary. They are the one that receives the death benefit when the insured dies. There can be more than one beneficiary on a policy. There can be as many beneficiaries as somebody might want to name. But you do need to know right away that the beneficiary is not a party to the contract, which means they don't have any rights or privileges in the policy, and which means they do not have to sign the application. So that's an important concept, that the beneficiary does not have any rights and they do not have to sign the application. Next, we have the policy owner. Now, the policy owner has all of the rights and privileges in a policy. And so let me show you a quick video about the policy owner here.
In this video, we're going to talk about policy ownership. Let's first take a look at an individual life insurance policy. Let's say we have Bob. Bob would like to buy a policy from his agent, Jane. In this case, Bob is going to be the applicant, the owner, and the insured. Now, it's important to note that as the owner, Bob is going to have all the rights and privileges in the policy, such as paying the premium, making changes to a policy, and naming a beneficiary. Now, let's look at another example where Bob wants to buy a policy on his kids. In this one, Bob, who is the parent, Jane, who is the agent. Bob, as the parent, wants to purchase a policy on his kids. He has two kids, Alex and Anna. Now, in this example, Alex and Anna, or the children, will be the insureds under their policy. However, Bob, the parent, will be the owner. This is an example of third-party ownership when they are different people. Another example of third-party ownership would be a key person policy. All right, so let's say we have Phil. Phil is the business owner, the employer. Bob works for Phil. Now, Bob is not just any employee. Bob is a key employee. A key employee is someone who has specialized knowledge, skills, and business contacts, a very important part of the business operation. Now, on a key employee policy, Bob would be the insurer, and Phil would be the applicant, and Phil would be the policy owner. This is also an example of third-party ownership.
One more example of third-party ownership would be like group life insurance. So let's say we have Phil once again as the employer. Jane is the agent. Now Phil, he has 4 employees that work for him. So we'd like to purchase life insurance for them. In this case with group life, the employees would be the insureds under that policy. However, Phil would be the applicant and he would be the owner. This is also an example of third-party ownership. Now, it's important to note in this example that since Phil, the employer, is the owner, he gets a master policy. Employees, since they don't own it, they do not get a policy. But group participants do get our certificates of insurance. And this is very important to note for your test that group participants get certificates of insurance. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you soon.
All right, so that is an example of policy ownership and how you need to know it for your test. Next, let's go into some application procedures. The application you need to know is the main source of underwriting. This is what the insurance company uses the most to gather information about the proposed insured. There's 2 parts to an insurance application that you need to know for your test. Part 1 is general, part 2 is medical. That's all there is to it. Okay, so you've got part 1 is what? General. And then part 2 is medical information. That's really all you need to know about that. All right, as far as an application goes, there has to be at least 2 signatures on an application, the agent and the proposed insured. Now, possibly 3 if there's third-party ownership. Let's say that you're my agent and you're doing an application on me. Let's say you make a mistake on that application. There are 2 ways to correct a mistake on an application. Number 1, you, the agent, would mark it out and have the applicant, me, initial the change. So you mark it out, have the applicant initial the change. The only other way is to start over with a whole new application. Please do not use whiteout on your applications. Insurance companies do not like that. Next, let's talk about an incomplete application. All right, so you're doing an application on me. You inadvertently skip over one of the questions. You don't notice it. I don't notice it because I don't even know what questions are on your application. And let's say at the end we both sign, you turn the application into the insurance company. All right, I'm gonna give you 2 scenarios here. First scenario is, let's say the insurance company does notice that this question is not answered. Do you think that they would answer it themselves? Probably not. Are they gonna give it back to you, the agent, and have you answer it? Nope, that's not it either. What has to happen is it has to go all the way back to the applicant and have the applicant answer the question. All right, your second scenario would be that the application gets turned into the insurance company and the company does not notice that the question is an answer and they issue the policy. And let's say I got killed in a car wreck the next day. Well, they can't come back and go, hey, wait a minute, we noticed this unanswered question on the application. We're not going to pay a death benefit. No, so here's the key. The consequences of an incomplete application will be that the company will have waived its right to ever have that question answered once the policy gets issued, and they cannot deny a claim because of the incomplete application. They have waived their right. All right, next, talk about representations. So let's say you're asking me a question on the application. The answer I give you is a representation. It is a statement that is believed to be true, but it is not guaranteed to be true. Because what if I have a few health problems and I lie to you? Because applicants will lie to you now. Well, then my representations become misrepresentations. It could be a small white lie that does not affect the underwriting or a big lie that does. That big lie is called a material misrepresentation because it was material to the underwriting of the policy. It would have affected if they would have offered me coverage or not. That material misrepresentation, that statement now becomes a warranty, an absolutely true statement upon which the validity of the insurance contract depends, because they kind of depended on me telling the truth about my big health problems, which means I have just committed fraud and it could void the contract. Now, concealment is just hiding facts. I might not be coming out and lying, but I might just be hiding those facts. Next, we're going to talk about a premium receipt. The most common type of premium receipt is a conditional receipt. A conditional receipt is only given to insurer to pay some premium with their application. So let me show you a quick video on the conditional receipt.
In this video, we will talk about conditional receipts. A conditional receipt is only given to insurer to pay some premium with their application. With a conditional receipt, it says coverage could be effective as early as the date of application if it needs to be, as long as they paid their premium and as long as the insurer would approve them anyway. It is intended to provide coverage on a date earlier than the date of the issuance of the policy. So let's take a look at a scenario here. We have Bob. Bob is the agent. Bob is completing an application on Jane. Jane is going to be the proposed insured. At the end of the application process, they both sign. Jane gives Bob a check for at least the first month's premium. In return, Bob gives Jane a conditional receipt. Remember, the conditional receipt. The whole purpose behind a conditional receipt at this point says that coverage could be effective as early as the date of application if it needs to be, as long as she's paid that premium and as long as the company would approve her anyway. So let's look at the scenario. Jane is driving down the road with a leisurely Sunday drive, and all of a sudden, bam! Here comes this deer out in front of her and kills her. Well, the insurance company, they haven't completed underwriting her policy. Underwriting would continue as long as they would have approved her anyway, and as long as she had paid that premium, then they would pay a death benefit to her beneficiary. Now, what if, however, Jane had said, you know what, I'm not going to give my hard-earned money just yet, which she didn't have to do, and she got killed in a car wreck. Would they pay a death benefit? No. So here's the key on the test, as well as in life, ladies. It's all about the money. Did money exchange hands to know whether there could be coverage in effect? Remember, no money, no coverage. So another example, on the effective date of coverage, when there's a conditional receipt, effective date will either be the date of the application or the date of the medical exam, whichever occurs last. So let's take a look at some timelines here and some examples for you. Jane completed her application on January 5th and paid her initial premium. Bob gave her a conditional receipt. 2 days later, Bob turned the application into the insurance company. A week later, they issued her policy. A week later, Bob delivers her policy. Now, what is the effective date of coverage? Well, your options are either A, the date of the medical exam, B, date of policy approval, C, date of application, or D, date of policy delivery. What do you think? Hopefully you picked C, date of application. All right, here's scenario number two for you. January 5th, Jane completes her application, pays her premium. Bob gives her a conditional receipt. 2 days later, he turns the application into the insurance company. A week later,
Jane has a paramedical exam. This is where a nurse comes out, draws her blood, and asks her more medical questions. A week later, they issue Jane's policy. A week later, Bob delivers that policy. What's the effective date of coverage? All right, so the effective date of coverage is either going to be A, date of medical exam, B, date of policy approval, C, date of application, or D, date of policy delivery. Hopefully you picked A, date of medical exam. Very good. All right, let me give you another one on the conditional receipt. January 5th, completed the application, but Jane said, I'm not going to give you my hard-earned money just yet. Bob said, no problem, you don't have to. 2 days later, turn the application into the insurance company. A week later, they issue Jane's policy. A week later, Bob delivers that policy. Now we need to know what's the effective date of coverage. So the effective date of coverage will either be A, date of medical exam, B, date of policy approval, C, date of application, or D, date of policy delivery. Hopefully you pick D, date of policy delivery. But here's things that have to happen on policy delivery. The agent always delivers the policy, has to have Jane sign a statement of good health stating her health hasn't changed. And the agent has to collect at least the first month's premium, and that's when coverage goes into effect. All right, I got more for you here, another timeline. Here we go, January 5th, Jane completes the application, pays her initial premium. Bob gives her a conditional receipt. 2 days later, he turns the application into the insurance company. A week later, Jane has a paramedical exam where a nurse comes out, draws her blood. Now, the results of this paramedical exam show Jane had nicotine in her system. Well, evidently, Jane likes to smoke a little bit. On her application, Jane says she was a non-smoker, but evidently, she likes to smoke pipes. All right, let's stop right there. Is the insurance company just going to decline Jane altogether because she's a smoker right now? Well, no. What they're going to do is they're going to rate her up. And we'll talk more about that later on. So let's start over with our timeline. Jane paid her premium. Bob gave her a conditional receipt. 2 days later, he turns the application into the insurance company. A week later, Jane has her paramedical exam. Nurse comes out, draws her blood. Remember, the results showed that Jane had nicotine in her system. Jane is a pipe smoker. She doesn't really like cigarettes, I guess. A week later, they issue her policy. A week later, Bob delivers her policy. Now, what's the effective date of coverage going to be this time? Your options are for the effective date either going to be A, date of medical exam, B, date of policy approval, C, date of application, or D, date of policy delivery. What do you think? Hopefully you pick D, date of policy delivery. And here's the things that have to happen. Remember, the agent always delivers the policy, has to have Jane sign a statement of good health, has to have Jane sign the amendment saying, okay, I agree to pay more money, and then collect that extra money, and that's when the coverage goes into effect. So that is your conditional receipt, only given to insurers who pay premium with their application. We'll see you on the next video.
All right, so there is your conditional receipt. Hopefully that was helpful. Next, let's look at some disclosures at the point of sale. First, there are disclosure statements. Disclosure statements help applicants make more informed and educated decisions about their choice of insurance. Disclosure statement could be anything, kind of like a buyer's guide that we're going to talk about in a minute. Next, there's a disclosure authorization notice, which states the insurer's practice regarding the collection and use of personal information. The insurer just needs to know that their personal information is being gathered, and then how can it be used, and just for underwriting purposes only. Next, HIV testing. Now, HIV testing, it's not against the law to do HIV testing. Usually for larger amounts of insurance is when an insurance company would do HIV testing. What you need to know for your test is who can have access to HIV test results. Well, if I'm the insured, I can. My doctor can. The insurance company can, and then the Department of Health and Human Services can. But I really want you to know who cannot have access, and that's why it's in your book, is anybody not involved in the underwriting process like other insurers. So other insurance companies cannot have access to HIV test results. Next, we have a buyer's guide. A buyer's guide is generic information. Explains how a buyer should go about choosing the amount and type of insurance to buy. A policy summary, which is going to be specific to a policy being issued. It will describe the features and elements of that policy. That could be anything like a brochure or possibly an illustration used in the sale of a permanent policy. Next, we have the USA Patriot Act and anti-money laundering. After September 11th, 2001, Congress passed the Patriot Act. All financial institutions are subject to the Patriot Act, and since insurance companies take in premiums, they are considered a financial institution. So usually, for any transactions in excess of $5,000, if the insurance company feels that transaction may be for an unlawful purpose, like they're being used to launder that money in any way, they would have to file what's called a suspicious activity report, or SAR. All you need to know for your test is that suspicious activity reports have to be filed within a certain number of days, and you need to know that number, 30 days. But make sure you know these other words also. 30 days of initial discovery. Because if this one question comes up on your test, there will be two answers with 30 days in them. I need you to pick the one that says initial discovery. Let's move on to underwriting. Underwriting is the risk classification process. This is where an insurance company decides who they're going to do business with and how much they're going to charge them. That's why they have underwriters. The first thing an underwriter looks for when an application comes in is insurable interest. Now, insurable interest is where the policy owner must face the possibility of losing money or something of value in the event of loss. Insurable interest must exist between the policy owner and the insured at the time of application. However, it does not have to exist whenever a death benefit becomes payable. So this is important that you know that insurable interest has to exist between the policy owner and the insured, which means who has nothing to do with insurable interest. And hopefully you're thinking beneficiary, okay? So make sure you know that the beneficiary has nothing to do with insurable interest. Three factors that may determine insurable interest are insuring his or her own life, insuring the life of a family member, relative, or spouse, or insuring the life of a business partner, key employee, or someone who has a financial obligation to them. And that would be like credit life insurance, which I will talk about in a later chapter. All right, so insurance companies gather our personal information. Where are they getting it from? Well, first will be the application. Remember, the application is the main source of underwriting. There's an agent report that gets completed by the agent. They could use that. They may require a paramedical exam. That's where a nurse comes out and draws blood. The results of a paramedical exam would give the insurance company your current health status. They may order your doctor records. That's called an attending physician statement. Or an APS. If they order your doctor records, that's going to give them your past health information. So make sure you know that paramedical exam is current health, where attending physician statement is past health. Next thing they will do is order a Medical Information Bureau report, or MIB report. What you need to know is the MIB was formed by insurance companies. It is made up of insurance companies. It is a nonprofit organization. That's where all of our information is kept. Anytime we apply for insurance, our applications are kept there. And anytime we use our insurance, the information is kept at the MIB. The whole reason insurance companies would get together and form the MIB is to help prevent what, do you think? Now, you might be thinking fraud at this point, but I have two new words for your insurance vocabulary. And those words are adverse selection. So adverse selection, my definition is sick people trying to commit fraud. Adverse selection is the insuring of risks that are of a poorer class or more prone to loss than the average risk. Because poorer risk or less desirable insureds tend to seek out and continue insurance coverage to a greater extent than better risk. So insurance companies got together and formed the MIB to help prevent adverse selection. Next, where they're going to gather some information are from some inspection reports. There are two we need to know for our test. First, there are consumer reports. Now, consumer reports are any written or oral information concerning a consumer's credit, character, reputation, and habits. And they get that information from employment records, credit reports, and other public sources. For your test, just think credit reports. That is a type of consumer report. Next, there are investigative consumer reports, basically the same thing, but they're going to take it a step further and they're going to go out and interview friends, associates, and neighbors of the consumer. There are two numbers associated with investigative consumer reports that you need to memorize. First, if an insurance company is going to do an investigative consumer report, the consumer must be notified within 3 days that the report is taking place. Then, if the consumer wants more information about what's contained in the report, they would have 5 days to get that to them. So just make sure you get your numbers down here, 3 days and 5 days for your test. Next, we have the Fair Credit Reporting Act. This is federal legislation. It established procedures that consumer reporting agencies must follow to ensure that records are confidential, accurate, relevant, and properly used. It also ensures against the circulation of inaccurate or obsolete information. That's why things have to fall off your credit report after a certain number of years because of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Now, if you get declined because of information from one of your consumer reports, like a credit report, for instance, you don't go to the insurance company to dispute that information. You have to go to the reporting agency like Experian or Equifax. So you don't go to the insurance company, you go to the reporting agency to dispute any information. And then the maximum fine for violating the Fair Credit Reporting Act that you need to know for your test, and this is for the Experian of the world, is $2,500 for violating the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So make sure you know that number on Fair Credit Reporting Act, $2,500. Okay, now let's go on to insurance companies that have gathered all your personal information. Now they're going to classify you. What type of risk are you to them? For your test, there are four categories. You're either a standard risk. A standard risk represents the majority of the people in your same class. For me, it'd be males, age, height, weight, avocation, occupation. Covered as standard rate. That's going to be the majority. Now, if I have a few health problems, like some high blood pressure or some diabetes, then I become a substandard. So sub means below standard. If I am a substandard risk, that means that the insurance company is going to rate me up. Remember back on our conditional receipt, if they rate me up because I was a smoker, or we had Jane who smoked pipes, she is a substandard risk. She's going to get rated up, which means they are issuing her policy with an amendment. Another name for that amendment is counteroffer. They've come back with a counteroffer, which means that the agent delivers the policy, which means that the agent has to have Jane sign a statement of good health, has to have her sign the amendment saying that she understands she's going to be paying more money, and then collect that extra money, and only then would coverage go into effect. Now, if you don't have any health problems at all and actually live a very healthy lifestyle, then you become a preferred risk to an insurance company. As a preferred risk, you actually pay a lower premium than a standard risk. Or you might have so many problems they could just decline you altogether. So those are your four categories of risk for your test. These next two policies are both really illegal. The first is called a stranger-originated life insurance policy, or a STOLI, and that is not vodka, people. A STOLI is where a person purchases a policy on somebody they don't know, a stranger, with the intent of selling it to a third party and profiting financially. Well, that doesn't sound very nice. Well, most states have outlawed this arrangement because it violates the concept of insurable interest. That person doesn't have insurable interest, they're just trying to make some money. Next is an investor-originated life insurance policy, or IOLI. Basically the same thing as a STOLI. You don't have to know the difference, but just know that it also violates the concept of insurable interest. So that's really all you need to know about these two policies, is they violate the concept of insurable interest. All right, we're on the home stretch here for this chapter. We're gonna go into elements of a legal contract. We will use the acronym COAL, C-O-A-L. The first is the C here, which is consideration. Now, you learned in an earlier video, the word consideration means something of value that each party promises to the other. For the insured, their consideration or value is paying the premium, but also make sure you know it's the answers on the application. That's important, okay, because how they represent themselves. So both their premium and the answers on the application. Consideration on the part of the insurer is promising to pay in the event of loss. Next, we have offer, and we're going to do offer and acceptance at the same time. The first offer is made by the applicant by completing the application and paying some premium, making an offer to the insurance company. Acceptance would occur when an underwriter would approve that prepaid application. Next, we have legal purpose. Once you get licensed, please do not go out and write up policies on people that are underage, high, drunk, not mentally competent to understand the contract or all the above. Okay, they must be of age, not high, not drunk, and they must be mentally competent to understand the contract, or it might not be considered legal in a court of law. And then for life insurance to be considered legal, these two elements have to be there. Both insurable interest, remember the policy owner has to have insurable interest in the insured, but then they also have to have the consent of the insured to take out the policy. So both insurable interest and consent must be there. Next, we have some unique aspects of insurance contracts. Got four words for you here. First word is conditional, and these are just bulleted definitions, by the way. Conditional means certain conditions must be met by both parties. And then on these next three words, unilateral, adhesion, and aleatory, let me show you a quick video on each one of those to kind of drive it home.
In this video, we'll define three words, unilateral, adhesion, and aleatory. Let's start with unilateral. Unit, meaning one, only one of the parties is legally bound. As the insured, you don't make any legally binding promises. All you do is pay your premium to the insurance company every month. Now, let's say you don't pay your premium. Are they going to come after you legally at that point? Well, of course not. All that's going to happen is your policy will lapse and go away. Now, let's say that you have been paying your premium every month for the last few years, and then you suffer a loss. Well, since you've been paying your premium, now the insurer is legally bound to pay for that loss. So unilateral, only one of the parties is legally bound. And then our next word is adhesion. Adhesion means take it or leave it. There are no negotiations in an insurance contract. So let's say you're the insured and your agent Jane just delivered your policy to you. Well, after looking it over, you're kind of confused and you're thinking to yourself, you know what? I don't think this is exactly what I wanted. And Jane, well, all she says is, I'm sorry. And so you think, you know what, Jane, how about if we negotiate this a little bit? Jane says, no, if you don't like it, don't take it. So adhesion, take it or leave it, there are no negotiations. And your last word is aleatory. Aleatory means unequal amounts are exchanged. So let's say you're the insured. You've been paying $100 a month for a life insurance policy from the insurance company with a $100,000 death benefit. Well, those amounts are kind of unequal, aren't they? So you pay a little to get a lot. So aleatory, unequal amounts are exchanged. So those are your three words for today, kids: unilateral, adhesion, and aleatory. See you on the next video.
All right, everybody. That is going to do it for this chapter over field underwriting. Now, go do some practice exams and let's see if the definitions have been memorized yet. We'll see you on the next video.